This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Joining us today in studio at our roundtable is Darcy Oishi. He's with the Plant Pest Control Branch of the State Department of Agriculture. He's responsible for emergency response, biocontrol, and identification programs. Aaron Bishop is the outreach specialist with the Oahu Invasive Species Committee. And joining us by phone, Tiffany Canini. She's the project manager for the Kauai Invasive Species Committee. And Franny Brewer is communications director for the Big Island Invasive Species Committee. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Are you there? No. Well, I'm so glad that you were able to carve out time for us. Darcy, you were here for our last show where we were starting to talk about some of the pests that we're seeing. And I know you had a concern for the number of calls that you're getting about the longhorn beetle. Talk about that.
Yeah, we've been getting increased volume in calls about Acalulepta aestetica, a longhorn beetle from Australia, the Queensland area, and not much is known about it. Literally, I would say my staff are the world experts on this beetle right now, which isn't saying much because outside of the scientific description of the species, there isn't much existing in the literature in Australia where it's not a problem, but it came. Is vying for kamaaina status here in Hawaii.
Okay.
So I like to be on formal terms on with it and call it Acalulepta aestetica and not get too familiar just yet because I don't want it established.
So what is it very destructive? What's the problem?
It can be very destructive. So it will chew boreholes into trees. First the adult lays the eggs on the bark and the eggs hatch, the grubs will then bore into the tree and it'll carve out galleries, think like your termites except bigger and with a large juicy grub that will eventually come out, pupate and turn into a rather large and stunning specimen of the Cerambycidae family. The damage can be such that it'll create weeping wounds in trees. And it does have the potential to kill a tree.
Will it get into furniture and houses?
We don't know. So far, it seems like it's associated more with living tissue, so things that still has green in it. We don't know the complete host range. And, you know, when I say that, we get a lot of anecdotal indications that, you know, they found it on this plant, but we like to make sure we can rear it out and identify it and confirm that this is indeed a host.
Now, is this something that people are misidentifying for the coconut rhinoceros beetle?
No, typically coconut rhinoceros beetle is mistaken for, well, people mistake the oriental flower beetle for the coconut rhinoceros beetle. So where coconut rhinoceros beetle is a lot bigger than the oriental flower beetle, Acalulepta aestetica is a lot bigger than the coconut rhinoceros beetle.
And it's no kidding.
Yes,
bigger.
Yes, it's bigger. And it has these nice, fancy, we call antenna, which create the horn name. They're not horns. They're just nice, big, juicy feelers. I'm sure some people mistake them just because it's a big bug.
So, Franny, what can you tell us? What are you hearing on the Big Island? Because the Big Island seems to be ground zero for a lot of new pests. Are you getting calls?
Yeah, unfortunately, it does seem like that. We get a lot of calls. Particularly, we've gotten a lot of information about people having the beetle via social media. So we have a lot of people posting pictures and saying, you know, I just found this bug in my house. What is it? So we see a lot of that. And we're working with East Hawaii Cacao Association and also the USDA Agricultural Research Center over here on a project to collect beetles. So we're trying to encourage people who catch beetles in their homes, who have live beetles, to turn them into us because, as Darcy said, often rearing out the larva to make sure that this is the beetle that you have is this particular beetle because larvae look very similar. That can take some time. If the larva dies, you don't know. So one of the projects that's being worked on right now at USDA is to get a genetic map of the beetles so that you can identify the larvae early and figure out what where they are and which trees they're in. So we're collecting live beetles in order for that genetic work to be completed. But so, yeah, we're getting a lot of reports.
So what are you telling people? Just stick it in a Ziploc bag or something and bring it in?
Yeah, most people are capturing them in jars. So any kind of jar or plastic container, just, you know, put a little hole in it so they continue to get oxygen and to bring that into us. We do let people know they do hiss and make some pretty interesting noises, so they can be a little intimidating, but the Puna residents are pretty tough, and we've been seeing a lot of people willing to capture beetles and bring them in.
Do they bite?
Not so far. Not that we've had reported, and we've handled a couple of them in our office ourselves, and while they're intimidating, no experience of biting and no reports of biting at this point.
Wow. Okay. And then, Tiffany, what about you? Are you hearing anything on Kauai? Are you there, Tiffany? Oh, maybe we'll see if we can connect with her later.
Well, so far it hasn't been reported in Kauai, so hopefully she's not hearing anything over there.
Okay. All right. We want to, yeah, keep it at bay. Erin, what's your experience out in the field?
With the beetle?
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had any experience with the beetle here on Oahu. But as far as beetles go on Oahu, we're pretty much supporting Department of Agriculture with outreach about coconut rhinoceros beetles, and we help take reports for that and then funnel it to Department of Ag so that they can follow up.
And so I understand that the summertime, you know, generally the pests are a little bit, I guess, maybe more active, Darcy. How are we doing on the coconut rhinoceros beetle front?
Coconut rhinoceros beetle front, it's... I'm thinking of responding with emoji, but no one can see it. Given our circumstances, we're actually doing pretty well. I mean, I'm not going to give it like a two thumbs up smiley face. We have a lot of challenges. What we're seeing right now is we're having beetle detections in some unusual spots. But this, like as you said, this generally happens in the summer months. They seem to be... moving more on their own and potentially assisted by people. Most of the big jumps, the other year we had a jump to Waimanalo that we were quickly able to determine that was not something of the beetle moving on its own. So we're having slight indications that there's movement. That's of concern. We have a large, we're tracking a very large breeding population in the Waiava area that we're hitting hard right now, and we've been manually removing most of these larvae and adults and basically all life stages, but we're actually getting to the point where we're going to be engaging with our partners in the area to actively manage in different ways the population, and hopefully we will see a drop in the trap finds, although because of the long life cycle of the beetle, what we do today, we won't really see the results of for another 3 months. So it really takes that long for us to really measure the impacts that we've had with our activities.
Where exactly is this find?
In the Waiava area.
Okay, because my understanding was that it was a city facility, and I was trying to pin that down with the mayor's office, I know it wasn't Environmental Services.
We have multiple breeding sites within the Waiava area.
Okay, but one of them is a city property.
Yes.
Okay, and is the city helping to mitigate that, or what's the typical response when you do find a large colony?
We've been in discussions with our partners, the affected landowners, to respond in ways according to what we know will work at killing the beetles.
What's a large number?
Large is we've removed several thousand.
Several thousand?
No, over 1,000 beetles. I think it's actually probably close to 2,000 at the various sites within Waiava. So there's multiple breeding sites
now
in the area.
We have seen when we discovered it on military property that they were able to go after it and really do a pretty good job in taking back the colonies, right?
Yeah. So, having been in charge of the response for a significant amount of time now, When we first found the infestation site on Joint Base, we stopped counting how many beetles we were catching. And we were counting how many buckets of beetles we were bringing back. And so that's the size of the infestation that we had that we couldn't keep track. But with the activities that the response engaged in with the military, we were able to not just control the beetle. We are headed into month. I can't do math on the air. I think it's about 18 months since our last trap catch at Mamala Bay. So our standard is we will monitor for 3 years a site before we can say it's been eradicated from that site. So we're more than halfway there.
Okay, but we're encouraged at the results that
we're
seeing.
Yeah, so the results look good. So while the situation in Waiava is a little different, there's more, the Navy had a unique opportunity. They had sole control over the area. They could dictate a lot and do a lot. And we're very good at following our directives and moving forward. The Waiava situation, because it's multiple landowners, because there's multiple uses in the site, that makes tackling the issue more difficult.
Okay. And I know the military's efforts included taking down some trees at the time, because I remember going out there to the golf course at Hickam Pearl Harbor and was really impressed at the speed at which they were really on it.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're looking at I'm pushing for a regional strategy for the whole Waiava area where all partners can agree to, and then we can address the issue. And again, hopefully, I think our efforts will see a downward spiral in the amount of trap catches, and we have wonderful opportunities coming with new technology being made available to us probably in October. We get a piece of equipment that should help us move forward in our attack, and also in actually just a couple of weeks we'll have a developing canine detector program. So we'll be training 4 dogs. Hopefully we have 2 dogs that are effective at detecting the beetles, and 2 handlers that are going to be well trained and ready to go.
Okay, so it's something new we're trying.
Yes.
Hasn't been done before.
It's been done on a little limited basis in Guam, and we had a program. We had a pilot program that was basically the proof of concept in 2014, but it's taken this long to create a more permanent structured program.
Okay, so when was that coconut rhinoceros beetle detected in Waiava?
Oh, in Waiava,
it's June. End of June now.
We've known about breeding populations within. We've had breeding sites in Waiava for, I want to say, 2.5 years now.
Okay, but then this large.
Yeah, the large population is that we're currently working to address is recent. It was April.
Okay. Well, if you're just joining the conversation, we're talking about invasive pests. Our guests are Franny Brewer, Communications Director for the Big Island Invasive Species Committee, Tiffany Kianii, a Project Manager for Kauai, and Darcy Oishi is the Biological Control Section Chief for the Hawaii State Department of Agriculture, and Aaron Bishop is the Outreach Specialist with the Oahu Invasive Species Committee. Tiffany, you're back on the line now. I just wanted to talk about your experience there on your island. You know, what are you seeing? What are your biggest concerns?
Right now, I guess our biggest concern is Koki frogs. The biggest concern of the Koi community is the continued and accidental introduction with Koki frogs in the area. A quick rundown is in 2019, KISC, in partnership with Hawaii Department of Agriculture, has captured about 9 Koki frogs at 4 separate locations on Kauai. What's really important about this is that the Koi community has been essential in keeping these from establishing a breeding population, because they quickly report it.
So
as always, they continue to report any Koki frogs that they hear in the area, and we're able to rapidly respond and get them before there's a large breeding population that takes much more effort to control.
Okay, and so then just quickly run down, what should people do if they, let's say, bring a plant home from a nursery or if they get it from a friend? What's the best practice, you know, that you're encouraging?
The best practice is to have plants on island, take from nurseries on island, and we also have a couple of nurseries that are Pono-endorsed nurseries, and they have best management practices where they really utilize ways of mitigating the spread of Koki if they are importing from off-island. That's by inspecting it. Some areas have it in a quarantine area to wait, because what happens is the Koki frog or the eggs can be hidden in either plants or other materials. It's not just plants that they're introduced in. And it takes about 9 months for them to start calling. So it's really to continue to survey the area if you don't know where you got your plant from. And as soon as you hear something that sounds like a Koki frog, is to call the 643-PEST hotline, which is Hawaii Department of Agriculture, or KISS directly, which is 821-1490. And the community has been essential in doing this on Kauai. They're pretty vigilant.
And KISS stands for?
Kauai Invasive Species Committee.
Okay, and if you don't know what a Koki frog sounds like, that's it. So if you hear one, definitely call that pest hotline. If you're just joining us, we are asking you to call in with questions or comments. Call 1-877-941-3689. Erin, we were talking earlier. You had mentioned that this new program that we might be launching with dogs, detection dogs out in the field. What's been your experience with that?
We've seen promising results. It's with conservation dogs in Hawaii, and they were looking to find ways that they can help the conservation community using regular pets. These aren't very specialized dogs. They don't specialize with German Shepherds or Beagles. It's really any kind of pet can be trained to detect certain kinds of plants and animals. So they're trying to work with detecting invasive snails and slugs. They're also looking to detect one of our target plants, which is called devilweed or Chromalina odorata, and they've had positive results. They've taken the dogs out, and the dogs have actually been able to find the plants without any prompting, and they were smaller plants. It wasn't a giant 9-foot bush. So we're hoping that this can be helpful and be able to be utilized with some volunteer programs that we have. We're finding that this plant is spreading mostly on the North Shore, and it's getting a little bit beyond what we can control when we find large populations.
What is devilweed?
So devilweed is it's sort of a cryptic plant. It's not very easily identifiable, but it's native to Central America and South Texas. And it's the biggest problem with it is that it infests disturbed areas like trail sides and forest edges. And it also disturbs and will sort of set up shop in areas where there's farming and ranching, and it's toxic to livestock. So we want to make sure that this isn't something that's a severe pest in Hawaii like it is in areas in Guam and other regions of the South Pacific and in South Africa.
And you went out with the team, I think this past month, right, looking at where this devilweed is found.
Yeah, so we have found a sort of a large population on the bike trails in the Pupukea Paumalu area. And this is a really big area. And so what we want to focus on, we don't want to just let it go. So we're working with the North Shore Trail Association, and then OISC is going to set up a volunteer trip to go up there once a month. And we want to clear the plants off the trail. So we want to really contain the site and prevent it from being spread further by hikers and bikers.
Is it just found here on Oahu?
It is at this moment, yeah.
Oh, gosh. So we really have to do our job and make sure it doesn't get to places like the Big Island or Maui or Kauai, if we can.
Right.
So, gosh, now this new dog program, I mean, as far as funding, I mean, we know we would probably all like to throw more money at this problem, but that isn't, it's easier said than done, I guess, right, Darcy?
Yeah. Money is a big issue. Our canine program for CRB is probably going to cost us about $130,000 a year. And fortunately for this program, it looks like we'll have stable federal funding as long as we're able to prove that it's effective. And I think that's I'm very optimistic that the dogs will be able to find breeding sites for us, and really looking forward to unveiling that program and seeing what kind of headway we're going to make once we are able to identify more breeding sites.
Okay. You know, we did have a call on the line, John from Eva Beach. He had a question about feral cats. I don't know if we've heard a lot about the concern folks have about toxoplasmosis, which is, you know, something that's transmitted through the feces of cats, and we have a lot of wild feral cat colonies, but I don't know. You folks want to weigh in on that? It's a kind of a domestic animal, but...
I'll defer. It's okay. Not my Kuleana.
Any takers on the neighbor islands for Annie or Tiffany?
Feral cats have always been a huge problem from a public health standpoint as well as from a conservation standpoint, because we do have the impact of feral cats around the world. Feral cats are considered one of the top 100 worst invasive species in the world, according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. So coming from that background, obviously, you know, we do have concern about feral cats. And I think also having had a background working in animal welfare, the one thing I just want to really urge is for people to spay and neuter their cats. That's the best thing that you can do to end the feral cat problem in Hawaii and elsewhere is to not allow your cat to have litters of kittens. So I'll say that and I'll leave it there.
Okay, and I know there was concern because we've had a number of monk seal deaths and they have attributed to toxoplasmosis. So it is a concern when you have that washing into the ocean. We have a call on the line, Peter from Kihei.
Yeah, hi.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, to the cats, I go to Kanaha at the airport in Maui, and there's a lot of cats, and they seem like be in good shape, but the grass has a kind of odor from the feces, and so for the cats. And why I'm calling for is... me and a couple neighbors in Kihei have a mango tree, and we just seen a pretty big beetle, like fingernail, probably bigger than that. A black beetle, it's like hummel, bigger than a wasp or a bee. And it just goes on the mangoes, and the mangoes are covered with them. And I was wondering if the cities or if whoever deals with that invasive species, if it's just started last year, if they are aware of it.
Are these ripe fruit or overripe fruit?
They go on a ripe fruit usually.
Okay.
And just one punctures it, and then there would be like 20. I mean, you don't see the mango even.
Oh, wow.
And do these insects have spots on the outside, on the back?
They do, and they're fairly big. There's like, half an inch.
Yeah, so that's the oriental flower beetle. So it's known to go after, they tend to like overripe fruit. They also, they can have negative impacts on fruit trees because they're not very good pollinators. So... They like pollen. They'll go after it, and they can negatively affect fruit set. And they're pretty widespread throughout the state right now, and we are getting more and more reports of it. I would classify it more as a nuisance pest than anything else.
Because I have been. Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been on these islands for many, many years, and last year was the first year that I actually noticed that my mangoes are getting eaten away before I actually have a chance to get on them. And also, we have a lot of fruit flies. I set a trap with the pheromones for males, and it's just full of fruit flies. I need to empty it like every month.
I would empty it more often
orange
than that.
Trees. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that, Peter. What can you do if you have this beetle?
Not much. There's not like coconut rhinoceros beetle, there's not very many solutions to dealing with it. The beetle is the adult beetle that people see and represents a problem for them is really not the phase that you really want to knock out. It's the grubs that are in. It's the grubs that are your best opportunity to attack and control the issue. However, the grubs are good detritivores. They are good composters. They process decaying matter very effectively. And so they're in mulch piles, they're in leaf litter, they're in, you know, they're basically turning the soil. So one could even argue that in that stage, the grub phase, they're a beneficial insect, but as an adult, they're really a nuisance. And that's what makes it hard. There's no trap for it that is exclusive to oriental flower beetle. And there's a small body of research into ways of controlling it, but it's not rigorous and it's not moving the needle appreciably in how to control this pest.
Okay, and if folks don't want to spray, some pesticides, insecticides,
yeah,
it's a concern then.
And you know, the number of pesticides that you can spray on your fruit crop that will affect the beetle, that's a short list.
Okay, we have another call coming in from the Big Island. Springer, you're on.
Hi there, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, so there was a recent journal article that talked about how many of the new invasive species that are showing up, like the Zocalolepta, they're showing up with no prior history of being a pest. They're either coming in from areas accessed by a new global trade route, or they just haven't moved beyond their range before. But maybe they're part of the same family as other pests, or there's some other clues. So I wanted to know if there's any new procedures that the state is using to try and assess the risk of species like these that are really starting to move around the planet for the first time and have no background as a pest, but could become really harmful here, or we could find out in time somehow.
Franny, do you want to take that one?
Well, I'm not the state, so I think that I've got to defer that one to Darcy, because we don't do that kind of pre-border work. So with the invasive species committees, our Juliana generally comes in once something is already here, and in, you know, the case of early detection, we're trying to find particularly plants, new things that are coming in, and respond to them, and with some education and stuff for some more widespread species. But as far as, you know, that kind of pre-border stuff, I think that would be Department of Ag.
Okay, Darcy.
So this goes back to my longstanding complaint of I don't like when people ask me what my top worst invaders are, because in a place like Hawaii, we can't really determine what is a risk. Most lists and most targets for priorities for survey and detection, whether it's at port of entry or beyond the port of entry, is usually based upon information that are not tropical areas. Hawaii is tropical. So, but Hawaii does pose risks for getting new things established that could be a risk not just to Hawaii, but to the mainland U.S. So there's already a problem there in how we get direction from our federal partners in how to proceed to help protect ourselves and the rest of the country.
Right, protect our borders.
So... this is something that the department has been asking for assistance on, conducting risk assessments, evaluations. But, you know, the list of unknowns out there is so long. I've also been looking at trends on where we find things coming in. So and what the countries of origins of these new pests are. So we've already identified some trends. Australia, for instance, seems to be a point of problem for Hawaii right now. Why are we getting these pests from Australia? USDA is not capable at this time of providing us with an answer. Hopefully they will be able to provide some insight down the line. But we've also been having conversations directly with Australia about, you know, what's going on, what can you share information with us on, you know, what you're seeing, how, and only through the communication are we going to be able to develop a better idea of how to target our efforts. And the reality is, being the state, I can't target the efforts of our federal partners who are responsible for looking at what might be coming in from a foreign source. I can make noise. I think I'm good at making noise. But it all depends on if people are listening in a constructive fashion and transforming our concerns into viable actions that will protect Hawaii. And that's the part that we really need to work on right now.
Okay, so maybe it's reaching out to our Hawaii delegation to see what they could do on the federal side.
It's also making everyone aware that we need to be gathering, we need to think globally more. And we cannot just state that the U.S. is just gonna, we can't just go straight to our federal partners, that we have to go to other countries and get information from them. There needs to be more information sharing and communication in order for us to really move forward.
Okay, and this is, I think, a priority, though, of biocontrols with the IGA administration.
Yeah, and so I'm supposed to be part of a joint task force later this week communicating some of these issues. Those are actually for biocontrol and ants, but we're having a lot of conversations to make sure that information is flowing between parties. And, you know, one of the big things is there is a changing pattern in globally in how pests are moving, and I think the response systems have to catch up in terms of how we look for and detect pests. And some of our old assumptions just are that old.
You throw them out the window and start anew, fresh eyes.
Well, you throw something out the window, usually you get hit through that window.
Okay. Well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Today we're looking at the different invasive species that sometimes pop up in our backyards. Do you have a species that you want to talk about? Let us know by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Saturday, June 29th in HPR's Atherton Studio. Expect a gumbo of musical genres from Tuality, offering a blend of blues, rock, Americana, and folk. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
Note to self, little tip for you.
On this week's On the Media, the selling and renting of land in America's free market.
The great state of Colorado, whew, it is fantastic for landlords. They allow landlords to basically run the table.
Our series on American eviction continues with tenants and especially landlords on the next On the Media from WNYC.
This evening at 7, right after The Body Show.
Back with The Conversation. And Darcy, you mentioned ants, and I know the little fire ant has been a real problem on the Big Island. Franny, can you talk about the efforts that are underway there now?
Sure. Little fire ants, unlike the other islands, when you have a little fire ant on the Big Island, you're kind of on your own. But we still have lots of areas of the Big Island that are not infested with little fire ants. So it's a really big issue that we look at from an education standpoint. Little fire ants are moved around through human activity. So the more we can encourage people to be very vigilant in what they're bringing onto their property and thinking about where those items came from, mostly live plants, but we've seen ants moving in things like lumber, roofing tiles, equipment, all kinds of stuff. So, you know, people who don't yet have little fire ants in the Big Island, and there are a lot of people who don't yet have them, it's really important to be vigilant about quarantining things as they're coming onto your property, really inspecting what you're bringing onto your property, thinking about that. And we have a program for people who are afflicted with little fire ants where we are teaching people how to effectively treat the ants on their own properties. So at this point, in areas where it's very widespread, you can get down to what we call zero detection in your space. And we really encourage people to get together with their neighbors, work with their neighbors on a treatment program. It's a year to 18 months of work. So it's something that can be difficult, but we do offer a program to the community to train people and then also guide them through that year, year and a half or so of treating ants to try and come out with that good end goal of zero detection.
So it is a challenge, particularly on the Big Island, when you have large, you know, areas of land, large tracts of land, and if something is infected, you know, maybe it'll fester and grow into a super colony, I don't know, before anyone really detects that it's there.
Yeah, I think super colony is the perfect word to use. That's exactly how we describe it. Because of the behavior of little fire ants, which is the relationship that the colonies do not fight with each other as they might in some other ant species. So with little fire ants, everybody's related, they're getting along really well. So a colony is made up of multiple queens. So with other fire ant species, and I think people who are from the mainland and especially the southeastern and southwestern parts of the United States where they have the larger red imported fire ants, you know, people are very familiar with mounds and treating mounds. And this is not a mounding ant. This is an ant that likes to find little hidey holes and can form exactly what you said, a super colony made up of many queens. Research on the Big Island has shown that in a area of heavy vegetation, just one square meter can hold 30 to 70 queens and accompanied by about 20,000 worker ants. So when you get to these high densities, which we do have here on the Big Island in certain areas, it can be a real problem. And the only way to effectively treat little fire ants is to use bait. You have to bait them, and you have to get the worker ants to work for you.
Right. You need the peanut butter test, right?
Yeah. So that's, I mean, and putting in a plug for all the other islands, we do encourage every resident of Hawaii on every island, including our own, to test for little fire ants at least once a year using chopsticks or coffee stirrers or, you know, whatever you have, putting out a little bit of peanut butter, half hour to an hour, and whatever ants you collect, you report those to your local IFC so that we have a record of, even if you don't collect ants, even if you get nothing, even if you get black ants, reporting what ants you're finding is really important so we can get a sense of what ants are out there and where they are. But this is really something that every resident of Hawaii should be doing once a year, because once little fire ants are established, it becomes nearly impossible to get rid of them.
Now, I know Maui, I think it was Hana, in the Hana area, had a infestation or a discovery of a couple colonies there, or more than a couple, probably a few. But that's, again, the same challenge. Large areas of land, and you know, by the time you detect it, it's like, yikes.
Yeah, exactly. And Maui, you know, they have several active sites right now, so they're really struggling to try and control those and prevent it from spreading further. And it really is going to be the community that is going to be the key with Maui and with the other islands in preventing fire ants from being established on the other islands, because it takes people going out into their backyard, as we've seen several times with detections on Oahu and on Maui, and doing those peanut butter sticks and checking for ants and finding it while it's still only a couple of acres and not letting it get established like it did here on the Big Island.
Okay, and what's the situation there on Kauai, Tiffany?
They were introduced to Kauai the same time they were introduced to Big Island. People didn't know that. Luckily, they were introduced to an area that a private residence, so it wasn't moving. they weren't moving around like when they were introduced to the Big Island. It was generally within the nursery trade, and they were moving around quicker. So we have the established population for multiple years, and with a partnership with Hawaii Ant Lab, based off of in Hawaii Island, and the Hawaii Department of Agriculture, we have brought that infestation down to almost undetectable levels. Can't quite be undetectable. There's a couple of hot spots that we are still controlling. The multiple-year effort that we have to continue to go out four times a year, control it as well as monitor the area to see if any other hot spots do happen, but this is because it was introduced in an area, and once it was introduced, all landscaping materials and everything was encouraged to stay on property, so they didn't spread it from one area of an island to another, and that's pretty important for our hopeful success of it in the end.
Right, so those biocontrols that are really important to prevent the spread. Darcy, I know we had a number of neighborhoods on the windward side that you folks were monitoring and treating. What's the latest on that?
So control programs are still ongoing. Detection programs are still ongoing, and that's because, you know, once you have little fire ant detected or any ant species detected, the ones especially that are highly invasive, the potential for them to move forward and off property, usually assisted by people, unbeknownst to them, is really high. So, you know, the more detections that we make in an area, the less likely we're going to be able to be successful in controlling it long term. And the reality is, for little fire ant, and we're just every island other than Big Island, we're buying time. There's going to be a point where, and I hate to say it, but the reality is that there's going to be a point where we just cannot stem the flood. And community involvement is critical, whether it's early detection or managing your own problem when you have it, that's going to be critical in the long term if we want to keep Hawaii a semblance of what it is, because little fire ant has the potential to change total ecosystems.
Right, and they nest in trees, and so if you're out hiking, and they could drop on you and bite
tree,
you.
Well, they are arboreal, but they go up in trees, but they can go on ground too. You know, most people think of ants only in a two-dimensional space, because that's how we normally interact with them. But yeah, one of the unique challenges on Kauai has been the ants have been at a height that we readily can't get to, and that has made it challenging for some of our issues on Waimanalo, where we have we know that the ants are up in a tree, but how do you kill the ants 100% in those trees, especially if those, you know, an 8-foot tree is much easier than a 15-foot tree, and if it gets taller than that, you know, the difficulties get magnified.
That's pretty scary. It's scary stuff. I'm sorry. We have a call on the line related to Little Fire Ant from the Big Island. Marjan?
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm unfortunately one of the unlucky ones. We are in an area heavily infested with fire ants. We treat our property, 5 acres or so, with bifenthrin-based products. We didn't have much success with Tango or Siesta. As you know, this product is quite toxic to bees and butterflies, and we do have hives on our property, so I have to be very careful, not to spray it on flowers. I wanted your recommendation on what's the best product to use, and as I know with many of these invasive species, some are developing resistance. Is a bifenthrin-based product such as Talstar in solution a good product to use, or should we combine it with something else? I'd be very grateful if you could give me some advice on that.
Thank you. Darcy, can you say anything?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a great question. We do not recommend bifenthrin as a widespread application for the control of little fire ants. Bifenthrin is a contact insecticide. So any insect that comes into contact with an area that's been treated with bifenthrin, the Talstar products, or Home Defense, the insects will be affected just by, you know, coming into that space. So using it on a large area, like 5 acres, especially with a lot of vegetation, we wouldn't recommend that, because when you're using your pesticides, you want to have as little non-target effects as possible. So we would recommend a bait product. Rifampicin is not a bait. And so generally what you see, the Hawaii Ant Lab designed a great gel bait that's using the Tango. There are also some ready-to-go granules that you can use if you're dealing with a space that doesn't have a lot of trees, so something like Amdro or Siesta. But we would definitely say the key that we see where most people don't have a lot of success is not keeping the timing. You have to do the treatments between a window of 4 to 6 weeks. So every 4 to 6 weeks, you have to be treating. And you do that consistently for a minimum of a year. And so this is where it can get very difficult, is sometimes people are waiting. You know, they might do a treatment and they don't have ants for a couple of months. And they think, okay, it's great. And then 3 months later, the ants come back. Well, they didn't come back. They just rebuilt their colony back to what it was pre-treatment. So we highly recommend using a bait treatment. And we do have information on our website that you can go to. And we hold regular events, particularly in Pune, where we train people. So check out bisque.org to find more information.
Okay. And then I think we've been fortunate. We haven't had infestations like they've seen on the neighbor islands. We did have that one in Waimanalo in some agricultural land. But is there anything else that you folks are looking at right now as far as acreage where these things might be found?
We're responding to a couple of issues on the windward side right now. And we're optimistic that we can get them under control and nip. Keep Oahu pretty clear, but we'll see.
Okay, so it's something you're monitoring at this point.
Yes.
Okay, and we have another call on the line. Brett from St. Louis, what's your question?
Hello. One of my neighbors is a pig hunter, and he said he's noticed a dramatic increase in the population, and he feels like the pig hunters can't keep up, and maybe they don't want to eradicate because this is their sport. He also mentioned that he heard that someone has crossed the feral species on the island with Russian boar genes so that they could get a bigger, larger pig, but it's more aggressive as well. So could you talk about the ongoing problem with feral pigs and all the erosion that is happening because of it? Thank you so much.
Aaron, you want to chime in on this one? This is St. Louis Heights, apparently.
So pigs are considered an invasive species just because of the damage that they cause in the forest. They root up native plants. They create holes that will fill with rainwater, and then mosquitoes move in. And so they are an invasive species. As far as eradication of pigs, at least on Oahu, I don't see how that's even possible. So pigs are pretty much here to stay, and we support people hunting pigs. We like to see people get out there and enjoy the sport. And also help take care of some invasive species problems.
Okay. So we'll have to, I guess, keep monitoring that situation with this Russian boar.
I have not heard of that.
Yeah, interesting. We'll try and run that one down. Anything else, Franny? I know we've been hearing a lot about rat lungworm. We're just about running out of time, but anything else you want to underscore about that issue?
We're very concerned about rat lungworm. We have a lot of illness on this island in particular. There's a lot of information about washing your veggies, but, you know, from the invasive species standpoint, we're really encouraging people to go after those slug and snail populations. And we're working a lot with schools to teach school children to stay away from snails and slugs unless you are protected, using gloves, using tongs, and to really remove them from the environment using a salty water slug jug, we call it. So there are things that people can do to really reduce the risk by reducing those slug and snail populations on their property. You can use baits, all kinds of stuff. But we think that every resident, again, should be looking around where they live and thinking, how can they make their property more safe from this injurious species?
Okay, and then I know the weather forecast calls for more rain. We're probably going to see some more slugs out there. And Darcy, I know you'd mentioned gnats. Were you bracing for the calls about gnats with the wet weather?
Yeah, so heavy rains usually bring an outburst of fungus gnats, and those are fun. There's no real control for them except for drier weather.
Okay. All right. So let's not pray for rain, I guess. But all right. Anything? Any final thought? We've got about maybe a minute. Tiffany on Kauai. Oh, we might have lost her. All right. Well, like I said, we've been focusing on invasive species, and hopefully our coming together of these experts around the table has kind of broadened your scope as to what we're battling out there on each island. It's all very different to different degrees of, I guess, kind of shoring up our borders with the multitude of pests that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. We would like to thank our guests, Tiffany Kanini, Project Manager for the Kauai Invasive Species Committee. Darcy Oishi is the Biological Control Section Chief for the Hawaii State Department of Agriculture. Aaron Bishop, the Outreach Specialist with the Oahu Invasive Species Committee. And Franny Brewer, Communications Director for the Big Island Invasive Species Committee. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. And if your call did not make it on the air during today's discussion, contact the Talkback line. Leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.